Thanks for being here tonight, everyone, and welcome to Hudson Institute, home of the escalation ladder. We're happy to host tonight's discussion, which so clearly aligns with the intellectual foundations of Hudson and our founder, Herman Kahn, who sought to help guide policymakers through the most difficult questions of the first nuclear age to the strategies to mitigate future threats. Today, our adversaries are modernizing and expanding their arsenals, sharing technology, integrating industrial capacity, collaborating tactically, and coordinating strategically. Nothing is more urgent than developing actionable steps to bolster strategic deterrence for the U.S. and its allies. Our speakers today served in a nonpartisan capacity for a project for the U.S. Institute of Peace to do just that. Each of them will provide remarks and then open it to discussion. This portion of the program is recorded. We'll then move to reception. Those of you who have not already moved to the reception, we hope you'll stay for that. I'll be brief in introductions because you all know their expertise. It's always a pleasure to welcome back to Hudson Dr. Brad Roberts. He is serving as director of the Center for Global Security Research at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory and served as one of the co-chairs of this strategic stability study. Dr. Rebecca Heinrichs, my colleague here at Hudson, director of our Keystone Defense Initiative, also served as a co-chair of this study. And Dr. Christopher Ford, a former Hudsonian, fellow and director of the Center for Strategic Competition at the MITRE Corporation, also a visiting fellow at Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Brad, over to you.
Thanks so much, and thanks to the Hudson Institute for making this available to us this evening, and thanks to all of you for making some time to come and join this conversation. I thought I would start with a little background on the project, and then Rebecca will delve more deeply into the substance. The background begins in 2019 or so, when the United States Institute for Peace had two projects on strategic stability, one on U.S.-Russia, one on U.S.-China. Both produced agendas for U.S. dialogue with Moscow and Beijing. And the response from Moscow and Beijing was politely, thanks but no thanks. Not interested in talking. And the project stopped. But that, of course, is where the hard work begins. It's not as if our interest in strategic stability disappears when the partners that we would like to have work with us to understand and protect strategic stability are not interested in partnering. So we stirred the pot for a while trying to figure out a pathway forward. And then the Institute decided that it wanted to go forward with a study on strategic stability in the new security environment on the premise that, yes, of course, we would continue to try to talk to Moscow and Beijing about these things, but in the absence of having a pathway forward with them, what should we do? We spent a lot of time, and so Rebecca and I were enlisted to be co-chairs of the study. We brought together a bipartisan team. We had a group of senior advisors as well, bipartisan in nature. We drew on the teams that had been part of the prior studies, but broadened our network a little bit. And we spent a little more than a year, roughly speaking, the last year of the Biden administration, deliberating how to frame this problem and define a strategy forward for the next team, whichever strike that might be. And we finished a report in February, and this is what we're here to discuss. We spent a lot of time deliberating, is the problem that we can't quite agree to stability, or is the problem managing instability? And we didn't finally settle that question, and the report reflects both themes. But there was a sense that the pursuit of strategic stability has been a pursuit of something that we thought we had in the past and had slipped away, and that Moscow and Beijing were willing to partner with us to recover. But that of course, is a sense of things that we've now had to give up. And so there is a theme about managing instability as opposed to pursuing or safeguarding strategic stability. We spent a lot of time, as every study group on this topic does, debating definitions. And I won't take you through our page-long definition, but it's brilliant. So you'll find it, I think, challenging in the sense that it says very clearly we shouldn't think of stability as a situation in which that's static. Stability is a condition related to change and motion. And we didn't take just the traditional American definitions of strategic stability, which very much have their roots in our historical experience. Our historical experience was that first in the 1950s and 60s, we discovered the challenges of an unstable nuclear relationship with the Soviet Union because we worried that in time of crisis, one side or the other would feel an incentive to go first with nuclear weapons. And so the concept of crisis stability was born. Schelling describes all of this, by the way, in a short chapter in a book, the last thing he wrote in 2011, which he described as the journey to strategic stability. And the journey was to two concepts, to the concept of crisis instability and to arms race instability. Again, born of the experience of the 1960s and 70s, the arms race that began, especially after the twin crises in Berlin and Cuba. But this is the legacy concept. These are the legacy concepts that have guided our public and policy discussions of strategic stability ever since. But they're not broad enough. They're not encompassing enough. It's not that they're not relevant anymore, but there's a more complex multipolar environment. It's no longer as bipolar in nature. The strategic stability problem isn't just a nuclear problem. It's an offense, defense, nuclear, non-nuclear problem. So we tried to parse out those issues in our definition. We then spent a lot of time talking about policy initiatives and what strategy would link them into a coherent whole. And the strategy we settled on had essentially three main principles. First, reprioritize deterrence. Second, refocused diplomacy. Third, invest in the enablers. By reprioritize deterrence, what we were reacting to our assessment, our judgment, that the United States had been reluctant to invest in the needed deterrence assets for the last 30 years. The focus in the nuclear policy realm has been on reducing the role and number of nuclear weapons, not determining the right number of nuclear weapons, for example. And the Biden administration's nuclear modernization program was defined by the administration as a replacement program, rather than a tailoring of the posture to the requirements of the new security environment. So we pushed in the direction of reprioritizing deterrence. On refocusing diplomacy, we said, yes, keep trying to talk to Moscow and Beijing, but shift the focus onto cooperation with allies. There's a lot that we and our allies can do together to promote strategic stability in the conventional domain and the non-nuclear strategic domains of cyberspace and outer space, and also in the nuclear space. And on investing in the enablers, essentially our point was we had two points. One, you need intellectual capital for this problem that we haven't much cultivated in recent decades. And you need political capital for these problems. Presidents need to get out and explain these problems to the public and to the Congress and stay engaged on managing them. So that's the background, and those are the main themes from the study. And then we went on to write a series of specific recommendations, and this is where Rebecca's going to pick up. Thank you.
Great. Thanks, Brad. That was a wonderful summary. I'm just going to highlight what I think is sort of big picture. We already have an expert audience here who you can go through and see some of the specifics we recommend, but I wanted to highlight what I thought was just really important and not to miss. And that's that we do in the report agree with the strategic Posture Commission and the National Defense Strategy. So we say right in there that this is yet another report, a bipartisan set of experts trying to, together, agree on the nature of the problem and offer a way forward. And so it is not exactly like the Strategic Posture Commission. We make our own recommendations, but we do make clear that we agree with it. We agree with the recommendations, and then we get into some other specifics. The other thing I think is really useful about this, and I actually was a little bit, I was very skeptical that we were going to try to do it, and now I'm really glad we did it. Thank you, thanks to my co-chair, which is a sort of a how we got here, the going through the history, and to try to get those of us in the room who may have worked in government at different times, different pieces of the U.S.-Russia relationship, to get all of us to sort of agree on what went wrong and how we got here was going to be as hard of a challenge, I think, as sort of coming up with some policy recommendations for moving forward, but we did it. And so I think that's very useful. It's very useful as a tool to explain to the average American and also to policymakers, members of Congress, so that we don't continue to try to do the very same things that led us to where we are, which is we're very behind. The other thing that's interesting about, Brad went through sort of how USIP was structuring the studies. Initially, we were just looking at the Russia strategic stability challenge. That was our task. And quickly, within, I think it was the first time we met, we immediately ran into the problem that you can't without talking about China. So we were not all here as China experts, nor are we Russia experts, but if you're going to talk about strategic stability with the Russians right now between the United States and Russia, it was impossible to do that without talking about the rise of the China threat and the nature of China's strategic nuclear breakout, which is what Admiral Chas Richard called it. And so I think that that's just notable because we kind of set out to do something a little different and then reached that conclusion that the nature of the challenge is such that you must deal with both of them. And then Brad already went through sort of what we had thought we were doing over the last several decades, that we Americans thought that we had a picture of what strategic stability was, and so we were moving forward with our nuclear deterrent program that way, and essentially just replacing the current program. That was our modernization program, really, since the Obama administration, while our adversaries were had moved into a different direction. So, as Brad said, we're going to refocus diplomacy to really work with our allies. We hammer really, really hard that it's not just that allies are an advantage. They are critically important for the United States to be able to shore up deterrence, the credibility of our deterrence, especially in theater. So we mentioned the risk of deterrence failure in theater and why it's so important to make some changes there. And then we do mention specifically the Sea Launch Cruise Missile Nuclear. So that is something that's different than the Strategic Posture Commission, is we do mention that specific system, and we recommend that the Department of Defense can move faster and accelerate that program within 5 years. And I think the date on this report is when we actually finished it, so it's February. That's really important because some of the individuals who were experts on the commission have since moved on and they're doing other things now. But it was February when we completed this study. And then we also were emphatic that we have to stay on task for the program of record. So anything that we do to strengthen theater nuclear deterrence, that's necessary and good, but it should not come at the expense of the program of record. And then we also make the point that we should strengthen homeland defense. And this is really important. We say to do so, the United States should rapidly and diligently build out homeland, cruise, ballistic, and hypersonic missile defenses and improve the resilience of critical homeland infrastructure to protect the nation against rogue nations and credible Chinese and Russian coercive threats. And then two last quick points. I'm going to turn it over to Chris. We also say that NATO, and I thought this was really important and worth really thinking about. NATO should conduct a new deterrence and defense posture review to update thinking about the needed appropriate mix of capabilities and capacities and how to deliver them through improved burden sharing. The assessment should determine what is necessary to maintain conventional superiority or over Russia, even if the United States is engaged in a major theater conflict with China first. So this is really important. So this is you have to deter both powers, but if the United States is dealing with the China threat, then we need conventional weapons in Europe to be such that it can handle the Russia threat. And that brings me to my last point, which was also in the Strategic Posture Commission, so really important, that if, and we said it a little bit differently, and I kind of like the way we say it here better. But we urge policymakers to address the gap between the needed two-war strategy and the currently planned one-war force. Without more robust deterrence of conventional war by non-nuclear means, including via elevated efforts by both the United States and vitally its allies, the United States will become increasingly reliant on nuclear threats. This reliance will become dangerous if U.S. threats to employ its nuclear forces are not seen as credible. And so really, I think, important point to sort of concentrate our focus on how important it is to get this right with a sense of urgency. And with that, I'll turn it over to you, Chris.
Oh, thank you very much. Since this was not only a bipartisan but a unanimous report, it goes without saying that I completely agree with everything else that my colleagues up here have said. But let me say also, not only is it a pleasure to be back here at Hudson, where I spent many years quite a while ago, although not in these swanky, nice offices. It was in the old offices on McPherson Square. But also, what an honor and a pleasure it's been to be part of this group with these two fantastic co-chairs. I'm just a ride along. These guys did the heavy lifting, and it's been a fantastic work product as a result of this. So thanks to you guys for all of your contributions. What I'd like to do is to highlight the things that jump out to me most from this report that I wanted to flag for your special attention. Because I do think the report makes important contributions, not just in terms of specific policy recommendations, which are critical, but I think also, as you've heard a bit, to the theory that underlies U.S. approaches to deterrence and strategic stability. So what I'll do is move a little bit from the abstract to the theoretical to the practical. But let me start with the abstract, and it's the definition of strategic stability that Brad mentioned a moment ago. We try to articulate in this report essentially an updated way to think about strategic stability. And I don't want to be too pedantic. I'll just read you a couple of one long sentence here. Strategic stability is a condition, we say, in which the political relations and military balance between states that pose an existential threat to each other are such that they perceive neither a compelling need nor a viable opportunity to advance their interests at the expense of the vital interests of the other through the use of military force, especially nuclear weapons. Now, this is a broader definition than many experts have hitherto used in the nuclear weapons policy arena. And I hope that this report will make it an influential definition, because I do think that the policy community has gotten itself into some trouble over the years by thinking of strategic stability too long solely through the prism of only one of its many facets, specifically that of nuclear first strike stability. And Brad certainly spoke to that. Now, first strike stability is obviously important. You don't want to get that one wrong, right? But in the real world, there is a lot more to keeping the global security environment from decaying into full-scale war and nuclear war than just that particular piece. And so our expanded definition reflects that. And so, I mean, this is a point of some frustration for me personally. I think the definition of strategic stability has been sort of in flux or unclear for a long time. I had the opportunity some years ago in 2013 to contribute to a book co-edited by Mike Gerson and Bridge Colby on strategic stability, published by the Army War College. And I think in that book, we probably had as many different definitions of strategic stability as we had authors, maybe more. So I hope that our group's contribution here sort of conceptually will be an important contribution, right? So now, I'm something of a theory wonk, and I'm a professor of defense and strategic studies with Missouri State University these days, so it's not surprising that I like the theory bit a lot. But that said, the most important contribution is the table thump that this report gives to practical policy recommendations. And those go to issues of the inadequacy of prior U.S. policy. Now, by that, I don't just mean in agreement with the Strategic Posture Review Commission that the program of record, while absolutely essential, is insufficient to our needs. It's not just about that. It is also about the fact, that's the sort of the policy recommendation. The program of record, we need more than just that. But it is also the fact that we need a different and new conceptual framework for U.S. strategy in approaching these issues. And I think our report draws attention to both of those, I hope, persuasively. We make clear very emphatically that the traditional U.S. prioritization of diplomatic engagement and cooperative measures with our strategic adversaries is no longer viable as a route to strategic stability. Presidents Putin and Xi, specifically, show little sign of actually wanting strategic stability, and indeed seem to view instability as being critical to their own global ambitions. So, through that prism, it clearly means that our traditional approach, which prizes that cooperative way to get to stability, has failed and may now, in fact, be dangerous. And as we say in the report, the U.S. strategy for stability since the Cold War is no longer applicable to the emerging security environment. And I'll quote again, U.S. attempts to reduce the role of nuclear weapons in its security strategy have been ignored and, in fact, exploited. Washington's calls for substantive, sustained, and high-level dialogue on strategic stability with both Moscow and Beijing have gone largely unheeded. And that's a full quote. So this clearly signals that our traditional strategy has failed to achieve its purposes in reorienting failing to reorient ourselves to these new threats. We in the U.S. have been, quote, negligent in preserving and adapting a strong nuclear deterrent. Those are strong words that you do not usually see in bipartisan unanimous reports. And I wanted to flag them because, you know, because I like being a little punchier here, and these guys are more diplomatic than I am these days. So I wanted to flag this, and we make a big point that there is no going back to the legacy approach, right? We say that the effort to cooperate with Russia and China to identify and safeguard shared interests in strategic stability has come to naught, a situation that cannot be expected to change soon. Now, we don't give up hope for cooperation in the future, but we do stress in the report that our diplomats need to keep expectations appropriately low and prepare for failure, another quote, right? So in that sense, I think the main lesson is that it is time from the report, that it's time for us to abandon what I myself would describe, although the report is much too decorous to use these terms, as the timid moralism and optimistic naivety of a conventional wisdom in strategic thinking that developed in a global environment quite unlike the one that we now face. Our leadership by example, the report does say, has failed, and we need to rethink our unilateral restraint, because Moscow and Beijing are already racing in a new arms race, and in response to that, we need to go forward in a new approach. So this is a big deal. Now, we do talk about cooperation with our allies, as Rebecca stressed quite appropriately. We stress cooperative action, but it is with our allies, right? And that's, you know, boldface, underline, italics, like as much emphasis as you want there, right? That is a critical piece. It is essential and structural to the project that we cooperate with our allies for the purposes of deterrence and achieving stability. That is something that cannot be said enough in the current strategic environment, especially when it is reported that the mental universe of our defense planning is steadily shrinking into a stale and antique 1890s hemisphericism. That is not the route to strategic stability. Now, we don't say that so boldly in the report. This is Chris Ford talking, but I do want to stress that we put a big emphasis on working with our allies. But working with our allies being important, it is also true that the fundamental sine qua non piece of this is robust American approaches to deterrence, because that is the pole in the tent without which the entire edifice collapses. So we make a big point of that. We draw out the call for specific policy things, turning the dial up a notch. The Strategic Posture Review Commission was quite clear that we need more than just the program of record. We begin to be a little bit clearer and show a bit more leg, as it were, on the kinds of things that we need to do. And I would encourage you all to peruse the report from that perspective. I recommend to slick a man. We also talk about the possibility of needing even more still. We talk about uploading. There are a range of things in there that I think will deserve, you know, will reward your attention. But this is a hard-hitting report that I think deserves, well, it's a sobering read, but I think it deserves our attention, and I'm really pleased to have had the opportunity to be a part of putting this out there and hopefully bringing it effectively into the public discourse, because these issues are ones that really badly need to be discussed right now. Thanks.
Great. We also have, I'm going to get a real quick check right now. If for those who want to engage in conversation on the record, if you have questions, I just want to see how many there might be. Because we also have a treat. We have the one and only Frank Miller, who has provided just a few remarks on what he thinks about the report as well, and has sent in a video. So, Ray.
I want to thank Rebecca for including me, however virtually, in this event. And I'm sorry I can't be there in person. I want to begin by applauding Hudson for holding this extremely important meeting. In doing so, Hudson is providing broader exposure and greater prominence to an extremely important study and report, which has not yet received the attention and discussion it deserves. In February of this year, the U.S. Institute of Peace's Senior Study Group on Strategic Stability released its report after about a year and a half of careful, in-depth deliberations. I want to congratulate the group on its work and specifically call out its two co-chairs, Hudson's own Rebecca Heinrichs and Livermore's Brad Roberts. Together, they steered a bipartisan group to a unanimous consensus report. No mean feat in these days. The USIP report follows the work of the bipartisan 2023 Congressionally Mandated Strategic Posture Commission and the 2024 National Defense Strategy Panel. It is, therefore, the third major report in 3 years to emerge, which presents, I quote, a compelling picture of a radically changed world. We do not yet know what the Trump administration will set forth in its soon-to-be-completed defense strategy review. Regardless of what it decides, we must be abundantly clear about the threats we and our allies face today. Russia and China, under Putin and Xi, are aggressively seeking to undermine our interests in Europe and in the Pacific, and they are increasingly acting in concert. Russia's brutal aggression against Ukraine, its ongoing and expanding campaign of gray area political infrastructure and sabotage operations against NATO, and its recent dangerous and bold intrusions into NATO airspace are a flashing red warning light. Xi is more circumspect, but no less committed to establishing hegemony in his part of the world. His dramatic military buildup speaks for itself. If we do not take steps urgently, as both the Strategic Posture Commission and now the USIP Strategic Stability Group have recommended, either dictator might mistake our actions, or lack thereof, for acquiescence or weakness, and blunder into an attack which sets off a global conflict. This underscores the point the USIP study group makes in its report, and I quote, "War between the major powers is increasingly likely," close quote. There is clear history here to serve as a warning. Had the collective West intervened to halt Hitler's annexation of the Rhineland, takeover of Austria, coercion of Britain and France into forcing Czech cession of the Sudetenland, and ultimately seizure of the rest of Czechoslovakia, or to intervene to stop Imperial Japan's invasion of China, World War II might not have occurred. But the failure to stop those aggressive dictators led to an unparalleled tragedy and the bloodiest conflict in the history of mankind. So the recommendations of the report you will be discussing this evening are both urgent, there's that word again, urgent, and timely. The U.S. government must speak clearly and directly to the American people and to our allied friends about the threats facing us. That's a key recommendation. Other key recommendations include the fact that we must ensure we have a robust strategic nuclear deterrent to include nuclear command and control, COOP and COS, and the nuclear weapons complex. Continuing the strategic modernization plan is absolutely essential. And we must strengthen our regional deterrence capabilities as well, because today they are currently not fit for purpose. To do so, we must accelerate development and deployment of SLCM-N, the Army's Dark Eagle and the Navy's conventional prompt strike long-range conventional hypersonic systems, and directed energy missile defense. We must strengthen homeland security by building and deploying a comprehensive integrated air and missile defense capability. We must encourage our NATO and Pacific allies to step up and do more independently and working with us. And we must put ourselves in a position urgently to be able to deter Russia and China simultaneously. Finally, let me add my personal view that we should avoid the trap Putin has set for us, and we should allow New START to expire in February, continuing to adhere to its limits would prevent us from uploading the Trident and Minuteman forces and from reactivating Trident missile tubes and B-52s for nuclear deterrent service, steps we should begin taking immediately in February. We should also call upon the Pentagon to submit plans to increase the planned buy of the new Columbia-class SSBNs to at least 15 boats and the B-21 buy to at least 150 airplanes. I wish you a spirited discussion. This is really important. Thank you very much.
Wonderful. Good to have Frank with us, at least by video. Really grateful for his encouragement through this report, and he really thinks it's got a lot to offer us, so really grateful for that. I did want to point out, too, and I'm going to ask each of my colleagues here, if you have questions, please do raise your hand. But if there's anything now, since this report came out, we finished it in February, a lot has happened since then. I recently had an article where I pointed out, you know, President Trump had mentioned that he really wants to engage in arms control and potentially arms reductions, and the Chinese immediately said no. And then they had their parade, the China military parade, showing off some increased capability. And so I also want to just, I mentioned in that article too, so I'll just mention that I agree with Frank that it's wise for New START to simply expire, that if the United States were to remain party to that treaty, at least unilaterally, that we would not be able to do what is necessary to increase the credibility of our deterrent to handle the two nuclear peer threats. So the logic that President Trump was persuaded by to pull out of INF, I think that logic applies here as well for New START. So I'll just say that. If there's anything else that you wanted to add that has happened since the report came out that is maybe worth noting that reinforces some of our recommendations.
Well, that's an invitation to get into trouble. Reprioritize deterrence, refocus diplomacy, reinvest in enablers. Reprioritize deterrence. We don't know what priority this administration attaches, and we don't know how it will make the choice between the spare dollar spent on conventional deterrence versus the spare dollar spent on nuclear deterrence. The pressure is, of course, very strong to strengthen the conventional deterrence posture vis-a-vis China. So they have a choice to make. I hope they follow our recommendation. On refocusing diplomacy, we're swimming upstream with our recommendation. Although I'd say the turn of events so far with NATO are more positive than we might have expected when our report came out or was finished. There are still big questions about the extent to which this administration envisions a role for allies in the same way that we do in the report. And investing in enablers, I see this administration acting the way all new administrations do on nuclear policy, which is figuring that they have assembled on their team the expertise they need, and that then they discover that it's a little more complicated than that. And I think that process of discovery is underway. So I think some important developments since the finishing of the report.
From my part, let me pick up on what Frank just said and Rebecca said about New START. If you look back on your Cold War history, you will see that the Kremlins are past masters of always proposing limitations that sound attractive right after they have secured some kind of an advantage that they wish to lock in place. So they move the SS-20s into Eastern Europe facing our allies in NATO, and we have not yet deployed a countervailing response, and all of a sudden they're very pro-nuclear freeze. We begin the Reagan defense buildup, and all of a sudden they have a proposal for the non-expansion of military budgets. Right? They have conventional superiority across the Fulda Gap during the Cold War in conventional and armored unit terms, for which we don't feel we have an answer except nuclear deterrence. And all of a sudden they're proposing a no first use treaty, right? So, you know, this is a playbook that is very well established, and asking us, as this report has stressed, as the National Defense Strategy sort of report has stressed, as the Strategic Posture Review Commission report has stressed, we're at a time when we are now, for the first time in my lifetime, right, because the U.S. nuclear arsenal has been, you know, coming down, if you look at the charts, ever since 1967. For the first time in my lifetime, because that actually was the year in which I was born, we now need to be in the up business rather than in the managing stability or reductions business. And it is not a coincidence that in that context, Vladimir Putin thinks it is appropriate that we extend New START's limits on operationally deployed strategic forces, right? That is just another example in that litany. So you know, this is not a surprise. We should expect this from them, and we should give the old Nancy Reagan answer of just saying no. So that's my point on recent comment. Finally, one thing I should have stressed that Rebecca was great to mention, right? Our report makes very clear that these issues are not ones that can be addressed just by a bunch of nuclear policy geeks who sit on podia and defense experts who come to listen to them opine, right? These things can only be fixed also by a collective endeavor of the American people, by American leaders who go to the American people, make these challenges clear, make the case for providing the right answer to these challenges, right? And in full awareness of the fact that answering these challenges are, you know, keeping the nuclear peace, keeping nuclear strategic stability, keeping broader strategic stability is not something that will be, over the next generation, easy, quick, or inexpensive, right? This is something that we need to be deciding to do together and to have the kind of collective buy-in that makes it possible to do so and to have a sustained approach and focus to these things. That is something we do stress in the report, and I can't agree with your comment on that, Rebecca, enough. We need to be making this case clearly and loudly and emphatically, and I hope this report will contribute to that, but that's only one piece of a bigger picture. Our leaders need to be engaged on making this case and selling it to the American people, and they need to do so not yesterday, not today, but day before yesterday. It is past time, and it's time to get moving.
If we don't have any sort of on the record. We do have one. Okay, great, go for it.
So you know, we're talking about uploading various assets that we have after the start expires. How do you all, that works as well.
Thank you. As we all think about uploading of the weapons that we have after the expiration of New START, how would you suggest we think through sort of the risk and the time horizons here? At what point does Putin really start feeling the pain of these uploads? Is it immediate because we have greater capacity to upload, or is it something that he feels a little bit of pain now but can match us, and only over time as our modernization accelerates, he feels the pain? I don't know if that makes sense.
You go ahead.
We don't know. It's a great, my suggestion, I'd be curious to know how my colleagues would answer this, but I think just making these muscle movements now would send an incredibly powerful, important signal. Frank did a great job in the video of laying out that, the Russians have engaged in nuclear brinksmanship while they've engaged in this conventional war against Ukraine. Increasingly bad behavior into other NATO countries' airspace, et cetera. And so I'm actually encouraged by President Trump's own specific sort of movements in this direction, his now approval of the United States helping with targeting longer range strike systems inside to Russia. That's farther than the Biden administration was willing to go in supporting for Ukraine in that way. And then, of course, just strengthening President Trump's just emphatic emphasis on the need for NATO to do more, and then also to cut off all exports of Russian energy that continues to fuel the Russian war machine. All of this is solidly building up the strength of the alliance that helps on the political credibility front as well. But I do believe that there's an urgent need then for the nuclear backstop to come into place in theater. And then for, we're on the wrong side of the timeline on Europe. Europeans making really big promises, and I think that they're genuine, but delivering on those in the timeline that we need, which is why some of this stuff, the uploading is the sort of easiest hard thing to do, if it's even hard. I don't even know if it's hard. I mean, it's one of the easiest things that we can do to signal that we will not be coerced, and he would be unwise to go down this path. So I'm actually very encouraged. We wrote this report. We were very sensitive to writing it in such a way that it could be used by and in line with President Trump's sort of early signals of what he wants, which is peace and stability. And he does not want the
strength.
And he wants peace through strength. But we argue for this is the way to do it. And so we're hopeful that that this would be useful to this administration and perfectly in line with President Trump's stated aims.
Sure. We've sent this, I mean, vis-a-vis Russia and vis-a-vis China, to me are slightly different questions when it comes to the issue of uploading. From the Russia perspective, we have sent the signal for years that we don't do arms races. We are terrified of arms races. We don't do up. We are afraid of things that seem new. Do you remember all the sort of theological, like, you know, angels dancing on the head of pins debates during the Obama administration about what counts as a new nuclear weapon, right? We've sent signals for years that, like, this is a space of deep neuralgia from the perspective of the U.S. policy community. And beginning to take these muscle movement signals to get ready to start going forward with uploading and to indeed to start going forward with uploading, that sends a signal that, by the way, those assumptions that you may have made about us being unwilling to play in this space and being unwilling to be competitive, those assumptions, sir, Mr. Putin, are wrong. That's an important signal. That said, the Russians can upload too. Right, and if it's just an upload race, we would end up maybe in the same place up here as opposed to down here, and we're still sort of, you know, staring at each other in a similar kind of way. I think uploading is more interesting. This is just me personally. This is not the report or my co-authors necessarily. I see uploading as more interesting vis-a-vis China, because at the moment we're on a time frame where DoD assessments, as far as I can tell, still hold that they are probably going to be at strategic parity circa 2035. Uploading pushes that. Doesn't necessarily push it a lot, but it'll push it to 2030, you know, X, right? And that's not a solution to the problem, but it helps, and it gives us more time in which to try to figure out what the better answers might be. So if you are interested in peace through strength, and if you are interested in trying to leverage a resolute American force posture for negotiation, and hopefully a better, you know, collective answer over time in the way that we did with SS-20s and the Euro missiles leading up to the INF treaty, perhaps. If you're looking for that kind of a solution, you need some time in which to work it. And uploading, at the very least, vis-a-vis China, gives us more time than we have right now.
Let me add one other theme. We followed the Strategic Posture Commission in making a distinction between strategic nuclear force and theater nuclear force. And we followed the Posture Commission in judging that the nearer term problems are at the theater level, and that the urgency of action to address force imbalances and dangerous perceptions is sharper there. Mm-hmm. It exists both places, don't get me wrong. But we felt that a decade of while Russian nuclear leaders have bragged about building a new nuclear scalpel for every military problem in Europe, a 2010 statement, I think. What can the NATO alliance proudly proclaim? Well, we've modernized the B-61 bomb. And not increased their number. Yes, we've improved the delivery system, but that mismatch is stark, and they have a theory of regional war, which depends on nuclear brinksmanship and coercion. We have so far as alliances failed to respond at the time, I would say this is an area where there's been some important progress in the last few months and in the last couple of years. But we're still lagging. And the highest benefits, if you're going to make new investments in new capability, putting something back in the field, prioritize the theater component rather than the strategic component. But do them both.
Great. With that, any more comments so we can move into the discussion piece that's not formal?
One coda. My own personal reaction to the Strategic Posture Review Commission report and to this one is twofold. As a guy who's been saying fairly hawkish and deterrence-focused things in the nuclear arena for quite a few years, I start by looking at these things and being delighted that, oh my goodness, it's fantastic to finally see bipartisan, unanimous statements by policy experts across the aisle saying forward-leaning and hard-nosed things about the need to meet these challenges. The second reaction that I have in looking at these things is like, oh my God, what kind of a disaster of a world must it be to get all these people to agree upon these things at the same time? And in some ways, that's the more important piece, right? We're not just saying this because this is kind of like the cool soundbite we want to put out there. We are saying this because we and all of the people that we know in this world face a set of strategic dilemmas that we have not faced for a very long time, and arguably because of this sort of three-body problem sort of thing, have never before faced. This is a world historically unprecedented challenge, and it's going to require a whole lot of effort and focus and attention and resolution in fixing and meeting that challenge. Hopefully we can contribute to that. We've certainly tried.
Well, and just to foot stomp that, I mean, again, we really try as carefully and as compellingly as we can to make the point that if we continue to do what we have been doing, which is continue to focus on diplomacy with our adversaries and prioritize that arms control, reduction, mutual, you know, understanding of strategic stability, we make it very clear that the Russians in particular, and this I'm just paraphrasing, are understand that that is our approach, and so they have been pocketing that for their gain and exploiting that. And so we it's imperative that we change our approach. And so the last thing I'll just say, because it's just so important, is the missile defense piece is really important too. And we're very specific about what we think the urgent need is. And it's to defend against that coercive threat from both Russia and China. And that is just, again, I think in line with the president's desire to have a much more robust homeland missile defense system. But we just make it very specific that there's an urgent need, that because our adversaries are really trying, in my view, just to weaken the American alliance structure, that they can coerce, they can threaten with a coercive strike against the homeland in order to cause the United States to believe that our extended deterrence commitments, our commitments to allies, simply aren't worth the possibility of escalation. So in order to strengthen the homeland, we have to improve missile defense to do that as well. And that also strengthens our ability to project power abroad and to maintain credible extended deterrence as well.
And you might think that we came to that part of our report on the basis of Rebecca's persuasion and passion on that particular subject. But in fact, it was almost a topic of no debate in the group. Democrats and Republicans lined up behind this main theme in the report.
Which is even more satisfying, by the way, in case you were wondering.
And I'd make just one other point, and that's that I think Chris has done an excellent job of highlighting, and Frank, the context, the consequence of this report, that it is not just interesting but important. And it's been another reminder of the signal-to-noise ratio problem in our national politics on these questions. This has gotten very little attention. It's unlikely to get a lot of attention. It's the latest in a string of commission reports that have pointed more or less in the same direction. And this should alarm us, that somehow the important messages, the important content of this kind of work is just not having much impact today. And I thank the Hudson Institute for giving us an opportunity to bring a discussion to all of you and to the online community. But it's really a sign of the times that we have such a difficult time getting the message out and received.
Yeah, I agree. And thank you also to our USIP friends who facilitated the work on this study and stuck with us all the way so that we can get it out for everybody to be edified by the findings and recommendations. We hope it will be a great use. So thank you all for being there. Please join me in thanking my great colleagues.